Well, I would imagine this is probably a pretty common human experience that we all go through at some point in our lives. But how many of you have ever been caught completely off guard by a sudden crisis that you just did not you didn't see coming? Maybe it was the fuel light coming on in your vehicle when you were miles away from a gas station. One of these days, I will share with you the moment that I prayed the hardest I have ever prayed in my life in the middle of nowhere, Indiana, late at night. I was not driving, but I was praying because there was a fuel light that was on and we were nowhere close to a gas station. Or maybe, and I just let all the students go, so they would be more, well, you guys might be able to relate to this. You're working on a paper or something and your screen goes black before you click save. And you're like, oh no, what next? We all have kind of the same physical reactions to that. Our breaths start, you start breathing heavier, your heart rate goes up, all logical thinking goes out the world's going to implode, this is the end of it. And we go into survival mode. And what's interesting is those are kind of the exact same emotions that we tend to feel when we move into the chapter that we're moving into in the book of Revelation. In chapter 6, because this is where the story really takes a dramatic and sudden and sobering turn. For the past 4 weeks, and really the first 4 weeks of this series, the view that we have had has been pretty majestic. We began by this, we've been having this upward perspective where we first saw Jesus revealing himself to John as he was walking among the lampstands, among his churches. And then in chapters 2 and 3, we listened in as Jesus was addressing those churches with messages of warning and encouragement. Over the last 2 weeks, we've gotten this peek through the door of heaven into the very throne room that has been filled with this with worship of the elders and the angels and all of creation joining in. Last week we met the Lamb, who is the only one who's worthy to unravel the mystery that we are about to dive into. And it's been a pretty incredible view so far. And today, the Lamb takes that scroll that we saw last week and he starts to break the seals on it. And the moment he does, the camera, so to speak, takes this sudden turn from the throne room of heaven. And it points directly down into the gritty, kind of blood-stained soil of human history. And the opening of the first four seals on this scroll unleash a thundering quartet of riders and horses that we have come to know as the four horsemen of the apocalypse. Now, for generations, these four horsemen have been kind of hijacked, I guess you could say, along with a lot of the book of Revelation. They have been used to spark paranoia. They have been used to kind of speculate and play a lot of end times guessing games. But I think when we read, as we have been trying to do throughout this series and throughout as we go through this book, as we read it through the eyes of those first century readers and we read it with discernment, and I'm going to use this word as we continue, as we read it responsibly, I think we start to see something a little bit different. Because what we find is that these four horsemen, and along with a lot of the other things that we read in the book, are not necessarily a puzzle about the future. Yes, they do involve some future things, but really they are a mirror that's held up not just to the present, it's also held up to the past and to things that are to come. The horsemen show us the exact predictable chain of events that happen when human societies try to run the world without God. And far from being something just to scare the daylights out of us, and that's not to say that they aren't disturbing, it's not to say that the things we're going to read are not difficult to process, but far from just being something there to scare us, really, the big idea that we uncover as we go through this should really draw us to this grounded, deep comfort as we look around at the things going on in our own world. Because the reality is, while the horsemen are incredibly good at what they do, they are operating on a short leash. They have strict boundaries, and most importantly, they lose in the end. You could say, we'll see how many people get this reference. You could say they are the Susan Lucci of the book of Revelation. Now, for those of you who got that reference, I know which one of you watch soap operas. I won't go any further into it than that. Very good at what they do, but at the end of the day, they lose. And before the final seal is broken on this scroll, as we have talked about, I think I mentioned this last week, we're going to come down out of the tornado of the chaos that the horsemen cause, and we're going to be reminded who it is that can survive this storm and how they survive and who it is who is completely and utterly in control of the entire situation. So let's look together at Revelation chapter 6, beginning at verse 1, as we start to meet these horsemen. John writes, "As I watched, the Lamb broke the first of the seven seals on the scroll. Then I heard one of the four living beings say with a voice like thunder, 'Come.' I looked up and saw a white horse standing there. Its rider carried a bow, and a crown was placed on his head. He rode out to win many battles and gain the victory." So the Lamb breaks the first seal, and this creature thunders a command to come, and a white horse charges onto the stage with a rider on his back that holds a bow and receives a crown on his head, and he comes out with one singular driving obsession to win victories and to conquer. Now, if we were to read this through like a modern kind of sci-fi kind of lens, we would picture this kind of demon-like figure appearing out of nowhere, coming out of the scroll and riding across the scene. And there is that image there, but again, we need to remember we're dealing with apocalyptic literature. There are images here that are pointing to realities that are kind of hidden, and John is unveiling, or it is being unveiled to John, and he is relating to us some of the deeper spiritual realities of what is going on. John's readers in the first century would have read that, and they would have known, oh yes, he's talking about imperial ambition. And if anybody knew what imperial ambition looked like, it was people who lived in the Roman Empire in the first century. In the ancient world, now today, we think about empires a little bit differently, especially post-World War II, but I don't know that the idea of empire has left. It just looks different. But in the first century especially, conquest was the ultimate goal of empire, and there was nobody better at it than Rome. Rome prided itself on its ability to swallow up nation after nation. And they would have swallowed up more, except for the fact that they were not the only imperial force on the landscape in the first century. Just to the east were their neighbors, the Parthians. Now, we don't know nearly as much about the Parthians because they didn't record their history in quite the same way that Rome did, but they were no less ambitious and no less bent on conquest. And they were so powerful that they were the only military force in the world at the time that Rome actually feared. Rome would have expanded farther east had it not been for the Parthians. And while Rome was known for their infantry and their legions, the Parthians were known for their cavalry. They rode majestic white horses, and they had the most gifted archers on the face of the earth at the time. In fact, they if you know anything about first century history, you might have heard of the Parthian shot, which was a military ploy to trick armies into thinking that the Parthians were retreating. Their cavalry would start riding away at a full run, only to have the pursuing army get close to them, and their archers would literally turn around in the saddle and start firing their arrows at them. And it was a very effective technique. So while by and large the image that John has in mind for the original readers is Rome, there are other empires at play here. It's Rome, it's Egypt, it's the Assyrians, it's the Babylonians, it's the Parthians, and it's every empire that has existed since. He's using this striking imagery to unmask the spirit that drives worldly empires. This white horse and its rider represent the human obsession with nationalism, with dominance, and with expansion. It's the script that says that our security is found in our military budgets and in our political systems and in our structures. It says that peace is achieved by outmuscling, by conquering, and by intimidating your enemies. And even though, as I said, empire looks different now than it may have 1,000, 2,000 years ago, it's still very effective. It's still very attractive. It looks majestic. It looks victorious. As this writer does, it wears a crown. But look at what happens. The moment that the first horseman runs wild in a society, he drags three other horsemen with him. Worldly ambition and conquest always trigger a chain reaction that ends up resulting in human misery. So as we meet the second writer in verses 3 through 4, it says this: "When the Lamb broke the second seal, I heard the second living being say, 'Come.' Then another horse appeared, a red one. Its rider was given a mighty sword and the authority to take peace from the earth. And there was war and slaughter everywhere." So the second seal opens, and a red horse charges out, and its rider is handed a large sword and given a specific authority to take peace from the earth. And the result, when peace is gone, is war and slaughter everywhere. Now, if the first horse represents imperial ambition, the second horse represents the systemic violence that is a result of that. When a nation or a people choose the script of the white horse, the script of conquest and dominance, it always tends to unleash the red horse, the horse of violence. Violence begets violence. And what's interesting is that, as we have seen over and over again in history, the sword that is used to conquer others on the outside is almost always the same sword that tears you apart from the inside. And notice what follows hot on the heels of the red horse in verses 5 and 6. It says, "When the Lamb broke the third seal, I heard the living being say, 'Come.' I looked up and saw a black horse, and its rider was holding a pair of scales in his hand. And I heard a voice from among the four living beings say, 'A loaf of wheat bread or three loaves of barley will cost a day's pay, and don't waste the olive oil and wine.'" So the third seal opens, a black horse arrives, and its rider holds a pair of scales. But lest you think that justice is coming, the scales that he holds does not represent the scales of justice. They actually represent the scales of inequality. Because the scale that he's holding is an ancient tool that was used for weighing food and currency. And the voice declares that as a result of the imperial ambition and the systemic violence, there's economic and scarcity of food and supplies. The reality is a single loaf of wheat bread, which what is it now? If you get fancy wheat bread, it's like $3, right? I make more than $3 a day. But a loaf of wheat bread or three loaves of barley is going to cost a man his entire day's wages. The black horse represents the economic hardship and famine that results when an empire goes to war. The economy fractures, inflation skyrockets, and the basic necessities of life, here represented by wheat and barley, they become luxury items. But that's only half of the story, because there's that little kind of strange line at the end of that passage there that says, "And don't waste the olive oil and wine." Olive oil and wine were not staple items. They were luxury items. They were the staple, they were the cash crops of the wealthy and the elite. And so John is kind of pulling back the curtain on this devastating economic result that comes from these first two horses. And he's saying that not only are the poor starving, not only does a loaf of bread cost a day's pay, but the luxury items, the things that the cream of the crop, so to speak, in the society you're living off of, that's socked away for a rainy day. Well, this just happens to be kind of that rainy day. It's a system where the wealthy are profiting off the inflation that is crushing the poor. And then finally, look at the fourth seal in verses 7 and 8. When the Lamb broke the fourth seal, I heard the fourth living being say, "Come." I looked up and saw a horse whose color was pale green. Its rider was named Death, and his companion was the grave. They were given authority over one-fourth of the earth to kill with the sword and famine and disease and wild animals. So the first horse is white, second horse is black, third horse is red, the fourth horse is pale green, the color of a decaying corpse. Its rider is death, and he doesn't come alone. He has a companion, the grave. And you could kind of picture them as, and this is kind of a humor, I'm kind of lightening the vision here. You've ever watched a parade? The last cart in the parade gets to pick up all of the stuff that's left behind. You know what I'm talking about? There's a reason they put the horses at the end of the parade. That's what the grave is doing. He's coming up and picking up all of the stuff that's left in the wake of the first three horses. This is the inevitable destination of an empire, of a people, of a society, of a culture that organizes itself without God, that relies on imperial ambition, that uses systemic violence and economic exploitation. It always ends in the exact same place, the pale green horse of mass death, disease, and decay. There are parts of the world that we can look at right now where that has been playing out for a long, long time. Now, if we were to stop right there, that would be a horrible end to this sermon. That would be a dark destination to end with. And we would fall into the exact same kind of weeping that we saw John do last week in chapter 5 when he's looking for one worthy to unlock the scroll. It looks like chaos is going to win. It looks like the horsemen are going to have the final say and have total control over human destiny. But again, this is where that crazy tornado of Revelation kind of sets us down and reminds us what's really going on behind the scenes, reminds us who is really in charge. Remember who it is who's breaking the seals on the scroll. It's the Lamb. And one of the things that you notice as you read this carefully is that you notice that the horsemen, as they come on the scene, they do not possess any authority of their own. They don't have any sovereign power. They are not running amok outside of God's control or outside of the sovereignty of the one on the throne. Look at the specific words that are used. A crown was placed on his head. Its rider was given a mighty sword. They were given authority over one-fourth of the earth. Even in the midst of human rebellion and breakdown and death and decay, God has placed strict boundaries around the chaos. The horsemen, again, are on a short leash. Death and the grave are given authority over only one-fourth of the earth, not the whole thing. Why is that? This is something we're going to see over and over again as we go through the book. That's because there's always mercy available. God's goal in all of this is not destruction, it's redemption. It's transformation. He doesn't want to destroy everything. In fact, the things that he's pouring out are for the very purpose of curbing the destruction, of bringing an end to the rebellion. But it does come in the form of judgment and wrath. And in this case, there's a sense that the judgment that God is pouring out, the wrath that he's pouring out, is not him actively taking punishment and throwing it at people. He's just kind of stepping back and taking his hands off the reins. As he releases these horsemen, he's honoring human free will. He's showing what the self-destruction that can occur when systems of the empire are allowed to run their natural course. He says, if you want to die, live by the sword, if you want to hoard wealth, if you want to build a culture without me, I'm going to show you exactly what that looks like. The horsemen represent the internal collapse of the empire when it functions outside of the sovereignty and the reign of the one on the throne. And again, the horsemen are very good at what they do. They disrupt economies. They launch wars. They fill graveyards. But they are inherently limited. They cannot touch the sovereignty of the one on the throne, and they cannot derail the final victory of the Lamb, which has already been accomplished. It kind of shows you why evil tends to fight so viciously and the darkness seems to be so aggressive. I think they know they've lost, but they're going to take as many people with them as they can. It's one of the reasons that you see God push back so aggressively. He knows he's won, but he's going to bring as many people with him as he can, because he loves his people. He loves his creation. But I think it's also important to see that what we're reading about here with the horsemen is that these are not just things. Now, again, we've talked about the historical context. John, obviously, in his writing, he's pointing to things that the church is experiencing in the first century through Rome. And there's also an element of there's things that we are still waiting to play out and to happen. But it is also a reflection, as I said, of things that are happening in our world right now. Nancy Guthrie writes, rather than seeing judgment only as something that will happen at the end of time, we need to see that even now, a world that has rejected and rebelled against God is experiencing judgment. That's coming, or experiencing judgment. It's not yet the final judgment. That's coming, but this world is experiencing a measure of that judgment now. But those shirts are so exciting. But that's only four seals. There's three more to go. As the fifth seal opens, we really start to see the human cost of the damage and the chaos caused by the four horsemen. Verses 9 through 11 say, when the Lamb broke the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of all who had been martyred for the word of God and for being faithful in their testimony. They shouted to the Lord and said, O sovereign Lord, holy and true, how long before you judge the people who belong to this world and avenge our blood for what they've done to us? Then a white robe was given to each of them, and they were told to rest a little longer until the full number of their brothers and sisters, their fellow servants of Jesus who were to be martyred, had joined them. These voices that we hear coming from under the altar, those are the voices who have suffered the destruction of the horsemen. They're the ones who have been picked up by death and the grave, specifically for the fact that they have not turned their back on the Lamb. They have pledged their allegiance to the one on the throne. And their cry Sounds very similar to something that we might cry if we experience the same thing. How long, O Lord, until you avenge us? How long until you vindicate us? They've suffered the destruction, and they want to know when God is going to advocate for them. And what I find interesting there is God pretty much just says, it's coming. Not yet. And they're given a white robe, which is a symbol of victory, a symbol that they don't have to worry. They've already overcome. That's why they're at the altar. And they're told, rest. History has to play itself out. That's what we're waiting on. And then the fifth seal opens, which really shatters the whole facade of imperial permanence. Verses 12 through 17. I watched as the Lamb broke the sixth seal, and there was a great earthquake. The sun became as dark as black cloth, and the moon became as red as blood. Then the stars of the sky fell to the earth like green figs falling from a tree, shaken by a strong wind. The sky was rolled up like a scroll, and all of the mountains and islands were moved from their place. Now, when we read, hearing those words, you might bring to mind certain hymns that we've sung, the sky rolled back as a scroll and things like that. And when we read about the sun turning black or the moon turning to blood and the stars falling like figs, we need to see that there's a couple of things going on with this imagery. Again, in the ancient world, especially those who would have been steeped in the Old Testament, the sun, the moon, the stars, they weren't just lights in the sky. They were what people used to navigate, to keep time, to track the seasons. They meant stability, and they meant that there was order to the cosmos. It's imagery that's drawn directly from the Old Testament prophets like Isaiah and Joel and Ezekiel, who used that imagery to refer to more than just the created order. Whenever they wanted to describe the political collapse of a modern global superpower like Babylon or Egypt, they used this same vocabulary. So when the Lamb breaks the seal and the lights go out, John is making a political statement. He's saying that God not only has the power and authority, if people wonder if he has the power and authority over the empires of the earth, they only need to see that he has authority over the entire created order, over the entire cosmos. And when he turns the lights off and he rolls the sky back, it isn't just cosmic theater. It's a declaration that humanity has placed their confidence in the wrong thing. It's a sobering reminder that only alignment with God's kingdom offers true security and peace. He has authority over the entire created order because he's the one who spoke it into existence. And how do the people who have trusted in the empire, who have trusted in humanity to be able to run things on their own and to secure peace and security? Well, this is, and you could call this an act of decreation. That's what theologians will call it. God created in the beginning, and then we see signs of he can not only create, he has the power and authority to just roll everything back. So how do the people respond? Well, this is what we read. Then everyone, the kings of the earth, the rulers, the generals, the wealthy, the powerful, and every slave and free person, all hid themselves in caves and among the rocks of the mountains, and they cried to the mountains and the rocks, "Fall on us and hide us from the face of the one who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb, for the great day of their wrath has come. And who is able to survive?" So God shows, he passes judgment. He shows his authority over not only the powers of the earth, but everything that has been created. And the kings and the rulers and the generals and the wealthy and the powerful, and not just them, but everybody else, slave and free, they find themselves huddled together in the same place, hiding in caves, trembling. And who is it that they're hiding from? They're hiding from the Lamb. Who hides from a lamb? Lambs don't have horns. They don't have fangs. I think sheep bite, but I don't know how much it hurts. What's frightening about a lamb? They're afraid because they see, as for another Old Testament allusion, they see the writing on the wall. The empire is not the one in authority. The horsemen don't hold the final say on what the scroll reveals. It's the Lamb. And if we're going to align ourselves with the powers and the forces that fight against the Lamb, we're going to find ourselves in the same place, hiding out, fearing the destruction and the judgment of the Lamb. They realize that all of the kingdoms that they have built, all of the things that they've put their trust in, are their fragile houses of cards, and that the true king is a lion that looks like a slaughtered lamb. Even today, we know the horsemen are riding. All you have to do is open up, well, who reads newspapers? Just open up the news app on your phone. We see the earth shaking. We see systems crumbling and fracturing. And the world increasingly is panicking. They're asking, who can possibly make it through this chaos? Or if they're not asking that question, they're saying, well, we're going to build a bigger, better system that's going to outlast the one that's crumbling right now. What they're going to find is that eventually that system is going to crumble as well. Who can possibly survive? Dun, dun, dun. Cliffhanger. Because next week we're going to answer that question. We're going to see the answer to that. We're going to see that before the final seal is opened and broken, God is going to pause this whole thing. And he's going to show us once again who's in charge and who it is that is able to survive the wrath and the judgment and the chaos. He's going to show us who has his mark of ownership. But in the meantime, this week, as you go through your daily life, as you go through this world, as you look around and you see the chaos, and you start to feel the anxiety, and you start to feel afraid, or you start to feel a pull toward the world script, remember, the horsemen may be riding. They may even be very good at what they're doing, but they've already lost the war. Trust the Lamb. Trust the King who holds your future. Trust the only one who is worthy to break the scroll. Wrap yourself in the white robe of his faithfulness, his righteousness, and rest in the assurance that the true King knows the way home and he is leading us there. Amen. Would you pray with me?